and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, tops and bottoms of all kinds, asexuals, homosexuals, metrosexuals, regular people who don't have sex at all. How about those people?
The terminally celibate?
I don't know who they are, but I don't think they exist. But according to some...
they exist.
That's the way that it should be. You know what I mean? I'm talking about... How you doing, Mark Riley?
I'm doing great, man. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. I got this this amazing batch of information here, this thing that I've had it sitting in my notebook for months about living under fascism by this guy Davidson Lohr. It's a big sermon, some sort of possessed clergyman of some kind. I got it off a website. Just breaks down all these different things about living under fascism.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Well, I kind of look at fascism much the way some people look at obscenity. I may not be able to define it, but I know it if I'm living under it.
Well, dude, this one is very interesting in relation to some of the stuff we're going to talk about today. Controls mass media. Sometimes the media are directly controlled by the government, but in other cases, the media are directly controlled by government regulation or sympathetic media spokespeople and executives. Censorship, especially in wartime, is very common. And this one, religion and government are intertwined. Governments in fascist nations tend to use the most common religion in the nation as a tool to manipulate public opinion. Religious rhetoric and terminology is common from government leaders, even when the major tenets of the religion are diametrically opposed to the government's policies or actions. Heavy stuff for morning time.
Well, it may be heavy stuff for morning time, but that's why you saw that pained expression on Putin of Russia's face the other day when he was standing there with Bush. You know, Putin believes that Bush personally controls the American media. He believes that it was Bush that got Dan Rather fired.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this is not, I'm not making this up. They actually apparently Putin brought this stuff up in the talks the other week.
Right.
Now, what's interesting about this is Putin has no particular problem with it. He just thinks Bush is being hypocritical by saying, on the one hand, you know, we want to, you know, spread democracy all over the world, while in his mind, he manages to get a major anchor fired.
It's the facade that Bush is, that's what Putin is like. Can't you just be a genuine fascist?
Yeah.
Can't you just accept that you are just like me and own it?
That's exactly what it is.
Well, I think, honestly, Riley, the thing is that Bush doesn't see himself like that. I think Bush has all these people operating at his behest that he actually thinks when he says, I got nothing to do with that, you know, that's a private company, that he thinks that it's a private company, that whatever goes on, he is like, he's like the evil version of the movie Being There. He's this sort of like evil idiot savant who underneath him has a sort of teeming bureaucracy of technocrats and fascists and bureaucrats that are guaranteeing that he, you know, it doesn't look like he is like a fascist leader. But
well,
he
you
is,
know what?
Except for his clothing designer.
No.
when he shows up with the epaulettes and the Pinochet jacket, the waistcoat, he definitely looks like the benevolent evil. Those are contradictory, aren't they? The evil fascist ruler of the neocon death cult.
Well, you know, one day soon, I want to get into this because there is, I think, an element of George W. Bush virtually in everyone who supports him, and maybe even in some people who don't. But George W. Bush is, you know, when you start talking about being an idiot savant, when it comes to foreign policy, see, because the savant means that every now and then you supposedly get it right. And this guy is now prepared to claim credit for everything.
Well, that's it.
Every good thing.
The only thing that trickles up, it seems, is when he's able to take responsibility or assume that he has some of the hand in the ebbs and flows of things that are good. This is one of the great arguments right now in terms of at what point do liberals and progressives and Democrats, in a sense, start to get on board with, we were talking about this the other day.
Yeah.
I think what you're referring to and what I'm starting to refer to is as the Middle East changes, we don't know for the better or not, but as things shift around, you know, he's going to, I think you're saying that he's going to start taking credit for
it. He will claim credit for everything. Government fall, you know, government changes hands in Lebanon. I did it.
I created the momentum.
Yeah, I created the momentum. Abbas and Sharon sit down, hammer out a few differences. I did it. Mubarak decides to open up Egypt to democracy. I did it.
But as you know, and as you always say, that, you know, what is really happening politically, you know, and what comes out onto the mainstream media as information is quite different in a lot of respects.
Well, yeah, and to me, it's like, how dare he step over the martyred body of Hariri in Lebanon, for example. He's the one that caused the change to take place in Lebanon, not George W. Bush. This man gave his life to democratize Lebanon and to get the Syrians out. Yeah.
And who took him out, Riley? I mean, you know, this is a weird thing because, you know, I got in my craw last night thinking about Hariri, this the ex Prime Minister of Lebanon, who was assumed to be shot by Syrians. But who the hell knows what's going on in terms of what covert operations this administration and the American government has been, you know, part of for years.
Yeah.
Who the hell knows?
Well, you know, we've had a couple of people on here, Mark, who have said point blank that they didn't think the Syrians had anything to do with it because they thought the Syrians really had nothing to gain. Now, let's look at what's happened here.
Okay.
You had Hariri assassinated. You had the Syrian-friendly government of Lebanon fall, and now you've got Assad, the prime minister of Syria, saying, hey, or president of Syria, saying, I'm pulling my troops out.
Right.
So, If there was some benefit to Syria in assassinating al-Hariri, we haven't seen it yet.
Well, this is the question that I'm asking, though. Maybe some sort of, you know, back, you know, some sort of backroom negotiations occurred in that, you know, one of the conditions that Assad had for pulling any troops out or even paying lip service to pulling troops out was to make sure that this guy was out of the way and was incapable of leading any sort of resistance or government there, you know, afterwards. Maybe this is some political action that was taking place on a covert level to guarantee that Assad, you know, would have some sort of free reign even with the new administration as long as Hariri was out of the way.
That's possible, but they still have not, and the United States has not, directly tied Hariri's assassination to the Syrians. What they've done, and it's very clever what they've done, I'll give them that, what they've done is to use the Hariri assassination to press for change that they wanted anyway in Lebanon and in Syria, because they still maintain that it is Syria that is allowing its border to be used as a essentially a point of entry into Iraq, and it bugs the bejesus out of them.
Yeah, you know, the concern that I have is the same as yours, is that, you know, now there are even some, you know, that when you look at democracy building, the idea of building democracy and the way it was done or the way that they're claiming it has been done in Iraq, is it, the real question is that's interesting for Democrats and for liberals and progressives, is that, you know, democratizing countries has been part of the liberal and democratic agenda for a long time.
Yes.
You know, how this was done was heinous, and it's still unfolding in a very heinous fashion. You know, there's human rights crimes being committed on every day. The business interests involved in Iraq are exploitive. You know, it was all built on lies. But at what point does the liberals and Democrats start to say, well, I hope that this works out? You know, well, I hope it seems that, you know, regular Iraqis are starting to have some voice for themselves. At what point do we start to acknowledge that and not give him credit?
Well, see, that's the thing. I have no problem in acknowledging progress wherever it's made. I do have a problem in giving this particular administration credit for that progress. I draw the line there and will not go any further. If there's progress being made, if you can say to me that 6 months ago Iraqis had electricity 4 hours a day and now they got it 20 hours a day, that's progress. That's good. Congratulations.
I'll tell you something. After you and I sat down and watched a bit of this film today, this Gunner Palace.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to talk to the director, Michael Tucker, and the captain who was in the movie, John Powers, who have been in Iraq. And I got a whole new perspective about how that, you know, how those troops are on the ground and what they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis and how much they are put in a position to mediate, help, be diplomats. I mean, I was fascinated because, you know, I am guilty of a certain amount of condescension, you know, certainly when it comes to, you know, the idea of war. You know, I am against war, and a lot of times I am not as empathetic or as, you know, connected to the day-to-day operations that troops have to go through and the stress that they're under, and also the responsibilities that far transcend what they are trained to do. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
They're coming in, and I'm looking forward to that. Also, well, I want to shift, as we were talking about before, in yesterday, we were covering some of the Frank Luntz 14 words never to use from the 160-page briefing book that has been, you know, handed out to Republicans and primarily to their spouses initially, so they could lie for their husbands and, you know, and do the propaganda work, you know, in their free time, because, you know, we know how you know, Republicans and conservatives, you know, feel about how, the responsibility of their wives in a lot of sense. But I also want to talk about, you know, some more of this, you know, living under fascism rant, this screed by this Davidson Lohr, because there's some fascinating, you know, really sort of fascinating kind of tie-ins or analogies. What am I trying to say? That we are living under the beginning of fascism. It doesn't feel like it to a lot of people, and we're obviously not completely in it, but it is starting, and we have to be aware of it. And we're going to talk about Frank Luntz and about propaganda and about some of these 14 words never to use, their attempt to reframe conversations on a day-to-day basis, and exactly what is coming from the other side after this. It's 17 past the hour on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition,
our highest-rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Twenty-one past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Now, look, I am not this guy, Frank Luntz, who, you know, I want to reach out to people out there who may be listening to us for the first time or don't feel that they are wonks or political
junkies,
addicts, or whatnot, because I'm not. You know, I mean, you know, this job has been an education for me, and I am still sort of not even halfway educated. You know, I am thrilled to be getting all the information I'm getting and looking at things in a completely different way. It's certainly a more informed way than I ever have in my life. And, you know, I thank God for Riley here, and thank God for the staff that, you know, we are able to sort of, you know, come together and put this stuff out for you. But Frank Luntz is a fairly, you know, has been known for years. Am I right?
He's been around for a long time.
He's a pollster. He's a Republican political consultant. He's the president of and CEO of Luntz Research Companies. He's one of a big operative for the neocon death cult and for the GOP. I'm going to start to separate those because they seem to be separating themselves, which is good. There's definitely a difference between the neocon death cult cabal of the, you know, the Cheney regime's government and standard, you know, Republicans.
Sure.
There's a schism now starting to happen, and I think we should celebrate that schism. It seems that some regular Republicans are waking up to realize, oh my God, we're only days away from having to wear uniforms or be killed.
Well, there's a big difference between Arlen Specter and Rick Santorum. They both represent the same state. They're both Republicans, but they're very different Republicans.
Well, Rick Santorum is a Christo-fascist zombie brigade robot operative.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, these are my own terms. I'll put out a glossary when I can. But getting back to Frank Luntz, he put out this book, this briefing of 160 pages that was originally designed for Republicans' wives so they could lie for their husbands effectively. And when they were having chit-chat with, you know, with the girls or with the guys or whoever, they could make sure that they were not speaking out of school. And we've gone through a few of them. There's 14 of the words never to use, not unlike the 7 words you can't say on TV or whatever, but... the first one is never say government, always say Washington. The second one is never say privatization or private accounts, always say personalization or personal accounts. This is the way they reframe. Three, don't say tax reform, say tax simplification, or as we would say, civic responsibility. Right.
Yeah.
Four, never say inheritance tax, inheritance or estate tax, say the death tax. Because that reframes it in a completely different way. We fleshed something out for me, Riley. What is an inheritance tax exactly?
Well, when someone dies and they pass their estate on to...
The government takes them. Okay.
The government takes a chunk, yeah.
So this is really designed, so it's primarily protecting people with a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. It is. In fact, it's like capital gains almost.
Right.
It's one of those things that a relatively small number of Americans ever have to encounter, but that small number of Americans actually inherit a sizable amount of money.
Well, that's the way I you know, I'm new to learning about this, but this is the way most people are wealthy.
Yeah.
You know, certainly most young people, that the real wealthy people are wealthy because of fortunes being passed down and continuing to grow and pass down, the snowballing of fortunes. Is that true?
Well, yeah. I mean, look at for example, Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
One prime example. Now, her parents are still alive. They're not old people. But, you know, when they pass, Paris Hilton will inherit an obscene amount of money, and she's apparently already decided to start spending it.
Okay, and here's where we sort of left off yesterday. Never say a global economy or globalization or capitalism. Instead, say free market economy. And the reason that Luntz gives is that more Americans are afraid of the principle of globalization than even privatization. The reason? Globalization represents something big, something distant, and something foreign. It makes them feel small, in other words. So he wants to make it seem encouraging. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the frames that we've been trying to put forth here on this show, you know, is that instead of, you know, and this is our example, it takes a lot of work to sort of reframe and to get a certain momentum around a frame. But instead of saying tort reform, we say, you know, restricting victims' rights.
Yeah.
Instead of saying right to life, or we wouldn't say that, but instead of saying anti-abortion, instead of saying abortion rights, what are their frames on that? We say reproductive freedom. We don't even say pro-choice anymore. I think reproductive freedom is where we're at with that one.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, what's some of the other ones we have? Oh, boy.
Well, okay. There are quite a few. But see, it what happens is these kinds of frames dictate the terms of the discussion, obviously, because media picks up on the frames and then recycles them to the American public. They really do have a very large impact on the extent or how Americans view this. And what you see Frank Luntz doing is dozens upon dozens of focus groups that come together, meet on these issues. Like, well, for example, when you talk about the inheritance tax versus the death tax, 68% of Americans think the inheritance tax is unfair. 78%, 10% higher, think the word death tax is unfair. Now, they mean the same thing. Why do 10% more people think the other frame is more unfair?
Right. And here's another one. The religious rights war on tolerance. That's another way to look at it. And some of this stuff is really simple talking points that you can use to combat these people. These people think they're right. You think you're right. But at least you can walk away from a conversation without feeling like you've been, made a fool of.
Sandbagged.
Yeah.
Well, we got the Palm Pilot and more coming up here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Honey.
Hey, 34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition. A lot of momentum already. It's only 34 past the hour, and there's a lot of momentum the first hour of the show. One of the other frames we were talking about Frank Luntz, who I'm going to surprise you with his schedule in just a second. But Frank Luntz is a pollster, a Republican operative, a neocon death cult puppet boy, but also old-school Republican puppet boy. He's the CEO of Luntz Research Companies, and we were reading the 14 words never to use, and this is Republican reframing. You know, we've gotten through about nine of them, or six of them, actually, and we're going to be going more through those in the rest of the day. Also, you know, presenting a couple of our frames. One of the other ones that I forgot about, about teaching intelligent design in elementary schools and junior high schools and high schools. That is denying children a fact-based education.
We got some more on that coming, too.
Which is another element of fascism, according to Dr. Davidson Lohr of the Church of Austin, the UU Church of Austin. What does that stand for? Universalist
Unitarian.
Universalist Unitarian. Broad. broad spectrum. Now, I'm not saying this guy's an academic or a philosopher or I'm not talking about religion here, but he had this, you know, inspirational moment in this piece he wrote called Living Under Fascism, which has been out for months, and I've had it stuck in my book. I just knew at some point that I would pull it out and go, wow, it's all here. Great stuff. I will be sharing more of that with you in a minute. Now, I don't even need to define what living under fascism is like, because in just a second, one of the great fascist tactic is underway on behalf of a representative from Alaska. But here, Frank Luntz's palm pilot was delivered to us by Ramon, who had a weird glaze in his eye. And he was just spewing, you know, talking points that sounded like gibberish. They were one after the other. But here's Frank Luntz's palm pilot for today. 5 a.m., wake up, shower, correction, use term, eliminating dirt entitlements. 8 a.m., pick up prescription for depression, correction, use term, adjustment to invasive joy anomaly. 11 a.m., go to lawyer about divorce, correction, use term, post-relationship right-sizing. Yes. 1 p.m., lunch, correction, use term, personalized nutrient fortification strategy. That sounds good. 3 p.m., go to proctologist. Correction, use term, clear colon initiative.
Whoa.
Yeah. 4:30 p.m., fire staff member. Correction, use term, reassignment to stimulate free market economy. 5:30 p.m., get stuck in rush hour gridlock. Correction, use term, anti-speeding containment scenario. And 10 p.m., bedtime. Correction, use term, war on fatigue.
Whoa.
I just want to lay these out quickly because it's going to set up our story here in a minute. Living under fascism. Here are some of the points that define a fascist country or one on the brink. Okay? One, powerful and continuing nationalism. Two, disdain for the recognition of human rights. We're going to be talking about this later. Because of fear of enemies and the need for security, the people in fascist regimes are persuaded that human rights can be ignored in certain cases because of, quote-unquote, need. Okay? The people tend to look the other way or even approve of torture, summary executions, assassinations, long incarcerations of prisoners, etc. Sound familiar? What's happening here, folks? What's happening in America? Three, identification of enemies / scapegoats as a unifying cause. To the point where we know where one is and we're not killing them. Bin Laden is in the basement of the White House where he has a bed, a cot, and there's a video production house there. Four, supremacy of the military, obviously. Five, rampant sexism. Interesting. The governments of fascist nations tend to be almost exclusively male-dominated. Under fascist regimes, traditional gender roles are made more rigid. Opposition to abortion is high, as is homophobia and anti-gay legislation and national policy. Interesting. Interesting. How does that all fall into place? Control. Six, control of mass media. Sometimes the media are directly controlled by the government, but in other cases, the media are directly controlled by government regulation or sympathetic media spokespeople and executives. Censorship, especially in wartime, is very common. Let's stop there and talk about this legislator, this Senate Commerce Committee Chairman, Ted Stevens, an Alaskan Republican, wants to, what, censor cable now?
What he wants to do is broaden broadcast rules against indecency to include subscription satellite television, subscription satellite radio, to go and cable, to go into these areas that people in fact pay for and apply the same kinds of indecency standards that are part of the broadcast industry. Now, this is a very important distinction that this guy is trying to blur here.
Yeah, we're supposed to, what are we, children? Can't we make our own choices? We're paying for the service, Riley. I mean, these people want to infantilize and control everybody. For what? To what end, Riley? I don't even get it.
Well, let me tell you something. Two shows that you wouldn't have seen on cable or on satellite had Ted Stevens had his way. The Sopranos and Sex and the City.
I get that, but I still don't understand what the agenda is here. Why deny us this? What is the means to an end? Is there any reason for it?
Yeah, there's a reason for it, because these folks believe that these indecency standards ought to be universally applicable. And what that means is that they would then be able to reach out, first of all, any kind of adult movie content, which, by the way, many corporations that run these services make big bucks off of, not to excuse them or whatever, but they make a lot of money off these services. They would be rendered illegal if Ted Stevens introduces legislation or tries to tack an amendment onto existing legislation to extend this control.
So this guy is an American fascist propagandist that's trying to redirect legislation to honor censorship, to honor control, to speak for people, to deny them choice on probably what is going to reveal itself to be religious or pseudo-religious ideals. That there is, this is, you know, it makes no sense to me. It is denying the fundamental freedom of choice of to people who are, you know, who are paying for a service. These chips have been around for years now. Nobody uses them. This is a small group of religious fanatic propagandists. What the hell does this guy stand to gain? He's sitting up there in Alaska dictating what policy about, you know, what I'm supposed to be able to watch on television. Well, who is this guy?
Well, he is the chair of the Senate Commerce Committee. Last year, they defeated an amendment. And this was attached to a bill that was going to boost fines for broadcast indecency. And they essentially, that bill, that amendment to the indecency bill would have extended this kind of control. And this control would have been exercised through the good offices of the Federal Communications Commission.
Well, here you go. Number six in living under fascism. Again, controlled mass media. Sometimes the media are directly controlled by the government, but in other cases, the media are indirectly controlled by government regulation or sympathetic media spokespeople and executives. Censorship, especially in wartime, is very common, controlling the mind of the people.
But let's look at the political agenda here. Where did Ted Stevens say this? He said this in an address to the National Association of Broadcasters. Why is that significant? Because the NAB represents over-the-air broadcasters who have a vested financial interest in leveling the playing field so that HBO cannot do a Sopranos, so that HBO cannot do Sex and the City. I'm not singling them out, but the broadcast industry wants to level the playing field because they're getting creamed by these shows that are allowed to say things and do things that they're not allowed to do.
But I'm not gonna let this just be a follow the money issue. It can't be. I just, not in my head. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but it can't just be that.
It's billions. It is follow the money because these folks are gonna, the NAB and their members, which by the way include people like Sinclair Broadcasting, is
right.
One example.
I understand.
They contribute to the campaigns of these same politicians. You have to follow the money.
Yeah, but I am following the money, but at behest of following the money, at behest of us, of our choices, of what we're willing and able to see on a day-to-day basis, they're making choices to regulate that and censor our ability to make choices about what we see by buckling people who are taking risks, who are posing questions. People, you know, like HBO, like other, you know, cable outlets that are putting it up the arses of this administration, that are calling them out on a day-to-day basis. They are stifling that voice, and it can't just be about money. It has to be about ideology on some level.
Well, they want at a point to reward their friends and punish their enemies. And remember that the distinction here is a very clear one. The Federal Communications Commission was put together to regulate over-the-air broadcasting because the inference was that the airwaves belong to the people.
Right.
That was the whole basis of forming the FCC in the first place, that broadcasting over public air meant that the people that held the licenses to do so had to have some bow to public interest.
I get it.
None of that stuff applies to the case. And by the way, that's why some people, his fellow Republicans on the same committee, guys like George Allen, who's a Republican from Virginia, said, I'm not thinking about doing this. Because he understands, you may not agree with him about anything else, but he does understand that you are blurring a very critical and crucial line here.
Right, but it only failed by one vote last time. And the other thing is I think that people like you mentioned, HBO, primarily, you know, free outlets to put on provocative subject matter are a real threat to the power structure. I just think they're a real threat to power. You know, given that all these other broadcasters, NBC and everybody else, feel gypped and feel like they can't compete. But the thing is that the nature, then why aren't they going the other way? Then why aren't they saying, look, give us a go-ahead to be filthy. Give us a go-ahead to fight in an open marketplace. If this is really about capitalism, why aren't they going the other way? Why are they honoring the ideological shift?
Well, they want, some of them do want the ability to do that. Some of them test the lines of doing it. That's why we see some of these, that's why they have a bill to increase the fines to over-the-air broadcasters for indecency, whatever indecency may end up being. They want to go further because they believe that they can make more money going further.
Right.
However, they also understand that they're in a different position because they are licensed. HBO's not licensed. You know, they don't have to answer to the American public every 3 years. Whereas a TV or radio station does have to answer to the American people, even if it's just a pro forma, you know, filling out some form.
Even if it's just, if it's like three people that write 10,000 emails apiece, you know, because of one of the Christo fascist zombie brigades, you know, gives them a form letter to
Dobson.
Do so.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and also like sex and violence in teens is down. The idea that, you know, that media causes this is starting to buckle. I think that these people are cowards. I think that these people are buckling to an ideological momentum that is dangerous in this country, and we're going to talk about more of that, you know, in terms of the abortion issue when we come back. It's 46 past the hour on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Did you? Fifty past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo,
having a feisty Wednesday.
Yeah,
there's no truth to Hump Day. We're all worked up here. What do you think about that? Ah, listen to that. That's the fax machine with the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today, progressives and liberals and whoever cares about this. One, today is Dr. Seuss's birthday. Drop acid and reread Green Eggs and Ham. See what's behind it. Two, after they take down the Christo gates from Central Park, have them reinstalled at polling places to increase voter turnout in 2006. Three, insist that Michael Jackson jury be half black and half white, like he is. Four, try to obtain federal funds to combat post-movie award season depression syndrome. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Gonzalez cracking down on obscenity is like rats cracking down on cheese, man. Go through his hard drive, man. I'll bet you find some real interesting JPEGs in that thing. Wake up, sheeple. The wet dream is over.
Woo.
Okay, so once again, I'm going to reread this. I'm going to reread one of these as we enter this next story. This is from Living Under Fascism by Davidson Lohr of the Austin Unitarian Universalist Unitarian Church.
There it is.
An inspired screed on, you know, a prophecy about living under fascism and what it looks like. Five, rampant sexism. The government of fascist nations tend to be almost exclusively male-dominated. Under fascist regimes, traditional gender roles are made more rigid. Opposition to abortion is high, as is homophobia and anti-gay legislation and national policy. Now, the Democrats, vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton and Harry Reid, have reached across the aisle, actually across the chasm. It's not even an aisle. They're reaching out to the worst of the right to try to get some common ground around stopping, or at least slowing down, not stopping, but starting to bring down the number of abortions in a logical, rational way based on science and analysis, right?
Yeah.
Riley?
Yeah, and Hillary Clinton in particular took some heat from people on the left. For actually the act of reaching out. And what she's saying is, look, we should be able to find some common ground short of banning abortions.
And banning sex.
Yeah, that too.
You know, I mean, this is like, this is not, I don't see this. See, I reacted to this story because I don't see it as a move towards the middle. I don't see it as something, I think she has just shown them for what they really are. These people don't care about abortions. They don't care about, all they want is control. I mean, in this bill, Reid's bill, it's co-sponsored by Clinton and 16 of their colleagues here. What's in there is more than doubling to $643 million federal funding for family planning clinics. Encouraging states to subsidize family planning services for more low-income women. Requiring private health plans to cover prescription contraceptives to the same extent they cover prescription drugs. All right. Promoting emergency contraception and ensuring its availability at hospitals that treat rape victims. Requiring federally funded abstinence-only education programs to provide accurate information when they broach the topic of contraceptives. All right, so here's what the response to this is by a Family Research Council.
Tony Perkins.
Tony Perkins, one of the crystal fascist zombie brigade leaders. Their idea, quote, this is quoting Perkins, their idea of reducing unintended pregnancies is more sex education and distribution of contraceptives. That's not the solution. That's part of the problem. If they want to start promoting abstinence, fine, but they won't. He just revealed himself for what he really is, a liar, a hypocrite. He doesn't care about helping people. He doesn't care about saving unborn kids. He cares about control. He is unwilling to wake up and realize the facts. Abstinence-only programs don't work. The propaganda they distribute through the government are lies. I have it right here, Riley.
Well, see, Mark, what you have here, and it really is about control, these are individuals who believe that women somehow joyously wake up one morning and say, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go down to the family planning clinic and have an abortion, as if it is something that they do for laughs. And anyone who has ever spent 15 minutes at an abortion clinic understands very clearly that that's not the case, that this is an agonizing decision, and that if for example, if this bill that Senator Clinton is talking about, or that Harry Reid's talking about, if that were to pass, then they might be able to get some kind of counseling that might stop them from having a second or a third or a fourth abortion.
Yeah, right. How about, you know, birth control? How about having the availability of emergency, the pills, the RUR.
The contraceptions.
Yeah. Contraceptive pills. I mean, abstinence-only sex education programs, a major plank in President Bush's education plan, have no impact on teenagers' behavior in his home state of Texas, according to a February 2005 study. In fact, teenagers in 29 high schools became increasingly sexually active, mirroring the overall state trends, according to the study conducted by researchers at Texas A&M University. All right, more research supports this conclusion. March 2004 study examining the sex lives of 12,000 teens ages 12 to 18 found that those who pledge to remain virgins until marriage have the same rates of sexually transmitted diseases as those who don't pledge abstinence. The study found that virginity pledgers are much less likely to use condoms because when you feel guilty, when you finally buckle, you're going to pretend like it's not happening. 59% of males who did not pledge abstinence use a condom during sex. Only 40% of male pledgers use a condom. 88% of pledgers have sex before marriage. All right, so kids lie. They lie when they're told what to do because you can't fight biology. All you can do is meet the kids halfway, educate them properly, and this will curb the number of abortions if they don't feel ashamed of their sexuality by these, you know, control freak, crystal fascist, zombie brigade asses who really believe this stuff is true. You can't beat people down. You can't make these things change like that.
But, you know, the other thing that has to be looked at very seriously here, Mark, is the manipulation of the statistics involved in all this. Underneath all of this rhetoric is the assumption that a majority of people who get abortions in America are teenagers, and it may not, in fact, be the case.
Well, that's it. Why don't they call out the conservative wives who are on birth control? Why don't they call out all Republican wives? Why don't they look in their own congregations
and
find the people that are on birth control before they open their fat mouths? All right, if you've got anything to say about this, 866-303-2270 is our number. We got a couple of calls we're holding. We'll be back with your calls after this. It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Cholesterol.
Six past the hour. It's Morning Sedition with Mark Maron. I'm me, and that's Mark Riley.
I'm me.
Oh, goody. Yeah, good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians. We're talking about fascism. We're talking about religion. We're talking about the neocon death cult. We're talking about censorship on behalf of the Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Ted Stevens from Alaska, saying that all of cable TV and radio paid services need to be censored, too, because he's one of the puppets. He's one of the ideological puppets shifting the seas in our heads, or trying to. All right, I've got a piece of a screed, a rant, a sermon given by a Davidson Lohr, PhD of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, about living under fascism that has inspired me this morning. This thing's been out in the ether for months, maybe even years. I had it stuck in my notebook. I just pulled it out. Rampant sexism is one of the sort of tenets of fascism. The governments of fascist nations tend to be almost exclusively male-dominated. Under fascist regimes, traditional gender roles are made more rigid. Opposition to abortion is high, as is homophobia and anti-gay legislation and national policy. And another one, religion and government are intertwined under fascism. Governments and fascist nations tend to use the most common religion in the nation as a tool to manipulate public opinion, then also to obfuscate the truth. The old bait and switch. Look, here's these moral values that aren't really making a difference. Why we steal everything from you behind your back. But religious rhetoric and terminology is common from government leaders, even when the major tenets of the religion are diametrically opposed to the government's policies or actions. We're talking now about abortion, about the Republican, or not even, I'm not even going to say Republicans, but the ultra-right, the right wing of the Republicans, literally saying to Hillary Clinton and Harry Reid, we don't want any help. You guys don't play ball the way we want you to play ball. They presented a proposal that would enable a slow decline in abortions in this country through education, through contraceptions, through family planning. And these guys said, look, if you don't preach abstinence, we don't want to hear anything about it, which really shows that, me who they are. They don't care about unborn fetuses. They don't care about anybody. These are not real Christians. These are not Christians that go out and do the charitable work for people that don't believe what they believe. They don't help people in a way that's empathetic or caring. They don't care about other people unless those people are in their congregation or believe exactly what they believe. They only want to control. They want everyone to be like them so they can have power. And that's what we're talking about right now. And we're talking to you on the phone. Alan in North Salem, New York. What's going on?
Hey, Alan.
Guys, how are you doing this morning?
All right.
I love you guys.
Thanks.
Listen, these people, it's not even about ideology. It's somewhat about power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Let's look at this thing about religion.
Okay.
We know what the Constitution says about religion not being in the public square. They want it in the public square. But if you talk about the Constitution and First Amendment and freedom of speech in terms of things that they don't like pornography or obscenity, mm-hmm. they want that done away with. They always want it, what they want, but they don't care about the law. And really, when you think about it, if they were true conservatives, they would let this stuff be in the public square.
Right. Well, they sometimes they'll let it be if it's in advertising and it's a little subliminal. Thanks
well,
a lot.
That's
for,
part well, of the perversion.
Yeah. All right, Alan.
No,
thank
but you know, Alan's absolutely
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
If you look at some conservatives, the Bill Buckley wing of the conservative movement in
right,
this country,
right.
they literally want the government off people's backs and out of the bedrooms. Now, when you talk about being out of the bedroom, how do you then talk about regulating what people see or what people have access to
in their
to
bedroom?
Look at? Yeah, in the bedroom. Or in the bathroom,
well,
or in the living
that,
room.
This is part of that schism we're talking about between the religious ideologues and the neocon death cult and, you know, regular fiscal conservatives.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And now look at the proposal, the Prevention First bill that Harry Reid and Hillary Clinton
okay.
are championing. Let's look at some of the tenets of this because, you know, we need to draw a very clear line of delineation between where they're coming from and where some of the people that they're trying to reach out to are coming from. This would, by the way, double federal funding for family planning clinics, encourage states to subsidize family planning services for low-income women, require private health plans to cover prescription contraceptives to the same extent they cover prescription drugs, promote emergency contraception and ensure that it's available at hospitals that treat rape victims, requiring federal-funded abstinence-only education programs to provide accurate information, which is the thing that you talked about just before in the last hour. The idea that if you're going to talk about abstinence-only, be accurate. Don't tell people that, you know, if they have sex, they're going to lose their ears or something. Let's be real about what we're saying, not just to children, but to young adults as well, because, Mark, you'd be surprised the kinds of ignorance that you will find in that 18 to 25 age group, which is not teenagers. You're talking about young adults, and they are, you know, they get access to some of the same misinformation as everybody else.
Well, let me tell you something. Many American youngsters participating in federally funded abstinence-only programs have been taught over the past 3 years that abortion can lead to sterility and suicide, that half the gay male teenagers in the United States have tested positive for the AIDS virus, and that touching a person's genitals, quote, can result in pregnancy. An analysis led by Congressman Henry Waxman's office found this out in December of 2004. Highlights of the report, of the 13 most common curricula, 11 used in 25 states by 69 organizations, quote, contain major errors and distortions. unquote. All right? What's in the federally funded curricula? Okay, here's something about gender roles. The five major needs of women include financial support, and the five major needs of men include domestic support. Quote, just a woman needs to feel a man's devotion to her. A man has a primary need to feel a woman's admiration. To admire a man is to regard him with wonder, delight, and approval. A man feels admired when his unique characteristics and talents happily amaze her. What is this? What year is this? Where are we going?
We're paying for this?
Number five is under, you know, Dr. Davidson Lohr's, you know, outline of living under fascism is rampant sexism. That's what this is. This is federally funded sexist propaganda. It's heinous. Let's go to Brian in Everett. Brian, do you ever sleep?
I live, when I'm up at night, it's like I'm by myself, and I like that.
Okay, this is getting sad already. What do you got to say?
About science, about the arts of love and sex and stuff like that. you need to surrender that part of your life.
Focus, Brian. Focus.
Focus,
Brian. That's right. Life begins when you say, God, I want to have sex with her.
Yeah, and I'm just saying, you know, and if you keep talking about all this stuff, you're not going to be able to, you're going to miss out on the kind of life that James Guckert has.
Gee, thanks, Brian.
Get on topic, Brian.
Okay, bye.
See you later.
See you later. Wow, he's deep. Brian is deep.
Brian up there in the bunker in Everett, Washington, doing the big work.
Yeah.
Okay, Patrick, listening in New Jersey on LIB. How are you, Patrick?
What's up, Patrick?
Good morning, gentlemen. Riley, I got a little bit of a challenge for you because I can only think of four of them. But the supposedly religious people that are so interested in legislating morality and all that stuff, why is it that they're so selective about which of the seven deadly sins that they want to, inflict on people? You know, I can only think of, like, sloth, gluttony, greed, and lust, and I can't remember the three.
Pride, envy, avarice.
Yeah, pride, envy, avarice, and there's one more?
Okay, go ahead. What's your question?
I think that's all seven. But anyway, I mean, they seem to be focusing on this lust thing. And, you know, it's like Republicans say they want, you know, less government and so on and so forth. Well, why are they legislating all this stuff that if they were such good parents that they would be teaching their kids in home? It doesn't have to come from a law. It doesn't have to come from school. It should be coming from the home, you know?
Well, see, they'll tell you that it does come from their home, because their home is not what they're concerned with. They're concerned with your home.
Right. Well, and also, they send their kids to school, and the kids are taught science and reason. That can't happen in a religious home. Don't bring that crap back into our house.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call, man. The seven deadlies: pride, envy, gluttony, lust, anger, greed, and sloth. Pride is the excessive belief in one's own abilities. That's a Republican tenet, for God's sakes. Envy, the desire for other people's traits. That is the core of competition in a free market economy. Gluttony, an inordinate desire to consume more than which one requires. That is the basic building block of American culture.
Yeah, right.
Lust, an inordinate craving for the pleasures of the body, one of the biggest subversive markets in the country. Nice.
Worth billions.
Anger is manifested in the individual who spurns love and opts instead for fury. There you go. There you go. Anger. Driven by anger. I don't know. I think there's a broader definition of that. Greed. We all know what that is. Sloth is the avoidance of physical or spiritual work. That's 70 million of you who didn't go out and vote and would just rather watch Survivor. Okay, man. We're going to continue this conversation with you and with us. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Join the morning tradition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning tradition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Wake up, monkeys. It's morning sedition. 20 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It feels good to be a primate today, to be possessed with the power of reason and rationality. We are talking about the slippery slope towards neocon death cult enforced crypto-fascist zombie brigade fascism. What is that?
Wow.
What am I talking about? I've been possessed this morning by this Davidson lore piece, this screed, this rant, this outline of living under fascism, because it all seems so appropriate. Right now, we're somewhere in the realms of religion and government are intertwined and rampant sexism. We're talking about the religious rights' inability to find middle ground with Democrats that are reaching out and saying, we can decline, we can make the number of abortions go down through education, through contraception, through making available family planning, through using the money properly, the federal money, you know, and these people are like, well, if you don't want to preach abstinence, then we don't want to hear it, which means they don't care about the unborn. They are not Christian behaving people. They care about this. It's malignant hope. They are incapable of dealing with real people around them and being truly charitable and empathetic. So they have this weird mythic land of unborn children and angels that they aspire to, but they will never reach. This is a culture of true sort of death worship. These are the worst kind of people in the world because they're liars and all they want is control. Let's take another call. Bobby in Phoenix. How are you, Bobby?
Hey, Bobby.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm.
What we need to do is the moderate Christians, the moderate Muslims need to get the crazy, manic, alcoholic behavior elephant that's dancing around our living room and getting ready to take us over the cliff. Because they are what they preach. They are the ones that want control. You are correct. It is fascism. They are a minority, but they have the power.
Bing.
Control.
The way you said that was sort of like, oh, thank God, like I passed.
No.
I know.
It is history repeating itself.
You're absolutely right, Bobby.
Take the time to read. Read the book War is a Racket by General Smedley Butler. Read the book Propaganda by Bernays.
Yeah.
Read the book The Viper Generation by Philip Wiley.
Yeah.
My God, we need to have what's called a confrontation and lovingly, just intelligently slap the whatnot out of our extremist brothers, both Muslim and Christian, because they are the ones that are totally confused. We need to have to stand up as Christians and Muslims and gently bring them back into line.
Okay, well, that's
speak about this.
As
you guys are doing, we need to talk about it.
You're absolutely right, Bobby, and I have a lot of homework to do. I have 3 books to read, and I have call us back, and I'll tell you if I read it. Well, I have the book Propaganda, but the other 2 I'm going to have to get.
Did you see this this latest thing with this legislator up in Maine?
No. Oh, yeah, what, the gay fetus.
The gay fetus. Yeah. This is a guy named State Representative Brian Dupree, which I believe our friend Rachel Maddow on Unfiltered interviewed the guy yesterday.
Yeah.
But he's filed a bill that would forbid women from ending a pregnancy based on the sexual orientation of a fetus.
So they don't even have that technology to know that yet. So I guess that this guy, who's obviously not a gay rights advocate, wants these kids to be born so he can proselytize them.
Well, he's no supporter of gay rights. He says this is a manifestation of his opposition to abortion.
But what this is a symbolic action being taken to humanize the unborn.
Yeah, and you know, he got the idea while listening to Rush Limbaugh.
It's a very interesting thing what these people are doing, because, as you said, not a gay advocate, you know, somebody who, you know, is relying on science that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
And he's supposedly championing abortion, you know, anti-abortion legislation. But really what he's doing, this is a ridiculous idea. It's a ridiculous bit of legislation. But really what it does is, this is a guy that says he's not gay rights. He doesn't, you know, he's not a human rights guy, but he's willing to use it, okay, to humanize the fetus.
Well, yeah, and what he's trying to do is to force people to choose between a woman's right and gay rights.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's trying to do. What he's trying to do is force the gay community to confront the idea that they might, under this bill, have a special protection. That a fetus who they could somehow, someday find out beforehand was gay, that person would be specially, or that fetus would be specially protected.
And yeah, and also I think maybe he's taken a step further, and maybe I wouldn't, you know, maybe he would actually say something like, do you want to deny the world another interior decorator or a hairdresser or somebody who works in the fashion industry, perhaps a movie executive? Do you want to deny the world? You know, why doesn't he say it that way?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. Even some people who are pushing, you know, some form of legislation, you know, expanding gay rights in the state of Maine are deadly opposed to this particular situation, because what it does is assume that someday they will find the dreaded gay gene. Mm. This is something that's been going around and been knocking around in religious conservative circles for decades now, that there's one gene that determines whether or not a human being turns out.
Well,
to be
I hope they have a test for that so we can test all these Republicans to see if they have it, so at least they can wake up and see who they are.
Yeah, right. It'd be nice.
Like, you know, if Rush Limbaugh were tested for the gay gene, wouldn't it be nice to know that he had it? And that, you know, all of his hostility just comes from hating me. Hating not me, but hating himself is what I'm saying. So you're saying they are throwing the abortion ball into the gay community's court.
This is something that you find more and more conservatives comfortable with doing. What they're trying to accomplish is to force you know, liberals and progressives to confront what they see. And when I say they, I'm talking about conservatives, what they see as contradictions.
Right. So, folks, we're going to shift gears here. Thank you for all of your calls. We appreciate your input. We will get to you another time. Coming back, we're doing our weekly dream interpretation segment, a little entertainment. We're going to lighten it up a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm going to share my dream. You share yours. You dig? It's 27 past the hour. Right, Riley?
There we are.
866-303-2270.
It's Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Did you?
It's been a pretty manic Wednesday. It's 34 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. The show is Morning Sedition.
Yes, it is.
Here on Air America Radio. Good morning, monkeys. Good morning. I'm proud to be a primate today. Look, later on the show, you and I watched a good portion of a documentary this morning that blew my mind. I know it changed your mind, too, in terms of, you know, what is going on in Iraq, how the troops are forced into positions and into responsibilities that they could never prepare themselves for in a very, you know, human way. I was really blown away. We're going to have director Michael Tucker and Captain John Powers, the film is Gunner Palace.
Yeah.
It's going to open, I believe, this Friday in New York. It really provocative stuff, and it really humanizes a situation that, you know, I have condescended, and I was happy to be taught a lesson this morning, and perhaps, you know, when talking to them, we're going to learn some more. That's later in the show.
Absolutely.
So I would encourage you to hang out. Right now, I'd like to share with you, as I do every day, in my self-centered way, my dreams from last night, because I'm moving towards my therapist appointment tomorrow. Here's my dream last night. So, and by the way, call us, 866-303-2270. It's your dream day as well. Well, I'll try and I'll give it a crack and interpret it. So I'm at the North Shore of Oahu, surfing with Howard Dean. And we are stoked, my friend. We're stalking the big waves, man. Not those little 15-foot mainland waves, but the gnarliest 35-foot Waimea monsters we can find. So we got to paddle out far, past the tourists and the wannabes and the rest of the no-nads. Back on the beach, we can hear some scared Democrat Frankie and Annette saying, "You're out too far. You'll get hurt. Remember Kucinich?" That just makes Dean paddle harder. After an hour in calm water, Dean says, "Brah, check it out." And just ahead of us is this huge, tasty wave starting to swell. It's rising and curling and rising and curling. We paddle hard into it. And just as I'm about to turn and stand up, Dean says, "It's all yours, dude." And he peels off. So I'm crouched down low over my board, and I can feel the spray of the pipeline over my head. I'm picking up speed, but not fast enough. And this wall of white surf comes smashing down on top of me, snapping my board and pinning me under the water. Dude, wipe out. So I'm underwater, right? And instead of floating to the surface, I feel a hand on my ankle pulling me down. I look down and see this horrible green sea monster latched onto me with these sharp fangs and gills and aviator glasses. It's Dick Cheney.
No one comes out this far, Democrat. You should stay in the kiddie pool. Suddenly, hundreds of hideous neocon fish with little American flags pinned to their fins start appearing and start laughing. Kiddie pool. Cheney's a scream, they think. Just as they swarm in to eat me, Dean swims up in scuba gear holding a spear gun. Dean says, "You look good mounted over my fireplace, fat boy," and skewers Cheney through the eyeball with the spear. The little fish scatter. We float to the surface holding on to Cheney's bloated carcass and then head back to the beach and have a luau. The only bummer? I gotta get a new board, man. I woke up and my bed was filled with poi. Yeah. Ooh. Now it's your turn. Give us a call, 866-303-2270. Tell us your dreams and we will interpret them. That's 866-2270.
303-2270.
Yes. Did I not say 303?
No, you did not.
Come on, we're the dreamers.
They're here.
Frank in St. Paul, what's going on, man? What's your dream?
Hi, Mark and Mark.
Hey.
Hi.
I'm a fervent Marxist.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you for being a Marxist. A Marxist.
Marxist.
Yeah.
Okay, we were at a meeting. I don't know what the purpose of the meeting was, but they introduced the first people, and then suddenly they introduced Hind Rocket and Big Trunk from that Republican blog.
Yeah.
And so they're walking into the room, and I'm just holding my finger up at them.
You're flipping them off?
Yeah, and there's a couple other people doing it, too, and I'm just looking right at them and holding my finger up, and then they left the room, and I'm with my partner, and she's sitting on the outside of the aisle, and I'm kind of just one person in, and I'm thinking, they're going to walk by, and they're going to smack me on the head when I can't see them.
Yeah.
And I kept worrying that I was going to be ready to stand up so they just couldn't come and hit me.
Yeah.
But there were papers all over the floor, like leaflets or something, and I was worried I'd slip.
So yeah.
I couldn't stand up very well, but that's what I was worried about. Then suddenly I was on the other side of the room, and they were about to show a film.
Right.
And I had no shirt on, and they start showing a film, and they talk about a fetus, and they gave it a human sounding things, like calling it a brat when it's kicking in its mother's stomach or something, and I thought, oh, they're going to start, you know, calling it a baby.
Yeah, yeah.
And then all hell's going to break loose here, I know. So sure enough, she calls it a baby when she's narrating the film, and my partner and another woman get up and start stomping out, and I'm like, oh, well, I got to go get my shirt and get my papers. I got to pick them up off the floor. And then I just rushed on my way out to meet up with her on the way out, and that was it.
Wow. So you were shirtless? You had to go back and get your shirt?
Yeah.
That's kind of weird. Well, you know, I think that obviously there's a theme to the dream, which is that, you know, this is a real set of people here. These people exist. We've been talking about them all morning. These are the people that, you know, have the views that are different than ours. And sometimes I think when you dream of a meeting, I think it means that you sort of direct your energies, focus them. I like the idea that you almost slipped on pamphlets, because I'm assuming that a lot of those were propaganda pamphlets of whatever movement that you were at the meeting. You think?
Probably. We were also at a Zydeco dance the night before, and there were leaflets for bands and dance partners.
Right.
And
so
all over the place. All and, that theme.
Wow. So and this is just the fact that you were sitting there, you know, sort of, you know, shirtless, you know, half naked and exposed. I think this is one of those dreams that's fairly political in nature, is that you're sort of feeling overwhelmed and you know, you're stuck in the middle of what seems to be this, you know, sort of right wing propaganda, you know, crusade. And maybe I think the dream is probably, you know, propelling you to take some more action.
You're a genius, Mark.
Okay. That's what it strikes me, because you were vulnerable. And then when you had to leave, what was interesting is your partner's pulling you out, and part of you need to go get your shirt back and also pick up your papers. Were you brought up in a religious home? Were you brought up in a conservative home?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right-wing father, strict Catholic mother.
Yeah.
A liberal who I brought to a meetup last night, so.
Well, that's interesting, because part of you it lives in that world, and you know, and thank God for your partner pulling you out of that, and you needing to change direction. Thanks for the call, appreciate it.
All right, Frank,
take it easy. Wow, that was wild.
I've always equated flipping people the bird to freedom for some reason too.
Oh, absolutely,
it was my own dream.
Of course, that was the whole '60s. You know, that was you know what I mean. Like, you know, who are you to tell me what to do, man? Jeff, streaming in Louisiana.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey.
How are you doing, man?
Second time speaking to you.
Hey, nice to talk to you, Jeff.
Okay.
What's your dream, buddy?
My dream is about one of three movies that really messed me up as a child.
Yes.
This is The Blob. It's a recurring dream. I've had it since sixth grade.
Oh, no. The Blob is that thing that just absorbs people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it the Steve McQueen blob?
That one messed me up, but then in 88, as an adult, the remake messed me up.
In a whole new way.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
but
dude.
But the blob has eaten everybody except me.
Oh, wow.
It's so large, you can see it from space.
Oh,
I'm trying to make my way up north.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to the ice where I can survive.
Okay.
You know, and in the dream, it's asking me, and I have to duck into this, like, sewer or this hole or something.
Uh-huh.
I think I can get away again, but it's a dead end, and the blob is closing in on me, and I wake up.
Oh, man. And you've been having this dream since you were a kid?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I got to be honest with you. I think this is a political dream as well, Jeff. I mean, where do you live?
Shreveport.
Oh, see that? So you're in the middle of Louisiana, which has got to be one of the sort of, you know, most, you know, backwater kind of political places in the world in terms of you know, there's just no liberals down there. There's barely any Democrats. Am I right?
Well, no, this is more of a purple state.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
We have Democratic governors, and my particular parish voted. I note the word parish, though.
Yeah.
My particular parish voted for
Kerry.
Well, okay. Yeah, well, that's good. You know, but for some reason, I'm still reading politics into it, and the fact that, you know, there's, you know, you want to get up north to where, you know, where it's supposedly, you know, more Democrats, more freedom, but it's still cold there. But that's right from the movie. See, I still think it's a political dream on some level, but you haven't having it since you were a kid. It might just be you're afraid of blobs.
It just messed me up. I'm serious. I was messed up.
I like that you went and saw the second one to re-mess yourself in a new way. Thanks for calling, Jeff. Yeah.
Wow.
It's been happening too long. I didn't feel like I did a great analysis of that, but I'm not going to beat myself up. I'm not a professional. Do you know what I'm saying?
You know, it's funny because there were a number of movies that were made in the mid-1950s, most notably Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that did have political overtones that nobody tried to mask.
I think that was one of those movies.
And yeah, I think the blob was.
And I think that there is, you know, it's sort of like The Crucible, the play by Arthur Miller, you know, you have something reflecting the McCarthyism of the time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or was that The Scarlet Letter? The Crucible. Was
no,
it?
The Crucible.
Yeah. But yeah, I think what he's saying, it is a political dream, especially in the country that we're living in now. Both these dreams are pretty revealing because they're more political than ones we've had in the past. That I think that there is that feeling of being suffocated by the propaganda and the momentum of the neocon death cult in this administration. Let's try this one. What do we got? We've got Ramon in Seattle. Ramona.
Ramona.
Hi, Ramona.
Ramona.
Yeah, hi, Ramona.
Ramona.
Hi,
Mark and Mark.
Hi.
What was your dream?
I'm actually working, but I got a few minutes, so... my dream, okay, first I have to give you some history. My sister is a evangelical Christian, watches the 700 Club all the time, and she voted for Bush. And that's the last time I talked to her because I scolded her.
Yeah.
And so a couple of weeks ago, I fell asleep listening to Air America Radio.
Yeah.
And I had this dream that she came to visit. I was living with my mom, who's handicapped, but she's a Christian but hates Bush.
Okay.
But my sister brought a couple of friends with her, and they were staying at the house, and they invited us to go to one of their sermons. And so my mom and I went, and I'm a Buddhist, but I went because, you know, I take care of my mom. So we're at the service, and at the end of the service, instead of saying amen or praise God, they did the Nazi salute and said Heil Hitler.
Oh,
and I said to my sister, what the hell is this all about? And she said, we believe that Hitler is a prophet.
Oh, my God.
So I told my mom we got to throw these people out of the house. They're demons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just got to ask you, Ramona, are you sure this was a dream?
I think it was a premonition. No, it was really vivid.
No,
I mean,
are you sure it didn't happen? It sounds a little too close.
I know. It's like right in line with what you were talking about in the last hour.
It's definitely a premonition. There's no reason, not to think that. It seems like all those symbols are pretty easy to read. If there's any way you can truly save your sister, I would reach out to do that.
I definitely need to contact her and say, get the hell away from those people you're hanging with.
Yeah, right on, Ramona. Thank you for calling us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ramona.
All right.
Okay, bye. So let's do another one. Let's see what we got here. Okay, Stephanie in New Jersey.
Hey, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your dream, Stephanie?
Well, I'm in Gotham City.
From the Batman comics?
No, but it's very dark there, and I'm at some sort of a rally, and there's men in suits that are talking, and there's one very tall man talking.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just listening to him, and I'm wondering why everybody is so stone-faced. And the man next to me, who's wearing some sort of a metal ring around his neck,
mm-hmm.
he says, would you like to know what they're not saying? And I said, yes. And he said, well, Iraq has ships, and they're coming over to the east coast of the United States, and they're going to bomb us, and they're going to take over the United States, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. And I said, you're kidding. And so he said, no, that's it. And so I tried to leave the city, Gotham City, and go over to New Jersey.
Yeah.
He can't leave because his collar won't let him leave the jurisdiction of New York or wherever that is. And I go to my relatives and I tell them, listen, we're going to be bombed and there's nothing anybody can do about it. Don't tell anybody, because that's what he told me.
Don't tell anybody?
Don't tell anybody, because he told me not to tell anyone. So I told my relatives, and I told them not to tell anybody. And they said, fine. And then they went to tell other people, and they told the other people, don't tell anybody. And they said, fine, and so on and so forth. And then my dogs woke me up.
Your dogs woke you
wow.
up.
Wow.
Wow. Stephanie, that's a head full. I got to work on that. Stay on the line. We'll come back, and we'll take a crack at it.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Hold on.
He's
we'll be back
right.
after this.
Join the morning tradition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning tradition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Hey, it's 52 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's morning sedition. We're in the middle of a phone call, a dream interpretation with Stephanie. Stephanie.
Yes.
Hey, boy, this is some complex stuff, so let me just recap it for our listeners who might just be tuning in. You dreamed that you were in Gotham City, and that there was a bunch of people, men with suits there. A very tall man with a suit was wearing a collar, and he said, do you want to know what they're not saying? And he basically informed you that the Iraqis have ships, and they're going to invade the eastern seaboard. So you freak out and said, we got to go to New Jersey. The tall guy with the collar says, can't go to New Jersey. You go to New Jersey. He also told you to keep this a secret. So you went to New Jersey, told your family, and of course they went and told everybody. So now the cat's out of the bag, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, you know what? This is some interesting stuff in this dream. I went to my references, and apparently, when you dream of somebody taller, okay, apparently when you dream of somebody taller, you feel like you don't have a lot of authority. You feel that other people know more than you, and that you defer to them. And that this guy, you know, obviously he is restrained. He can't go anywhere. The collar, like you said in your dream, you know, tethers him to this place. But you believed him for some reason. And this guy is a guy that you thought, you know, had the authority and the right and the right information. Now, apparently with secrets, a lot of the stuff that's revealing itself in this dream is that, you know, you're a little stifled, that you need to assert yourself a little more. When you dream of secrets, you believe that you have hidden powers and hidden information that you're not really sharing with other people, that you stifle your voice. And the whole invasion thing is also another indication that, you know, obviously there's political fears and there's a climate of fear, but an invasion represents, again, you feel powerless in the face of a lot of things that are out of your control. And oddly, warships also mean that you're, not just a rock in the political implications, that you might be very angry about some stuff and you're just not getting your feelings out there. Is that possible?
Oh, my God. I'm just a very happy person. I don't know.
I think there's something teeming inside of you that, you know, you there's a lot of anger and fear and a lot of feelings that, you know, you don't share a lot of these things with people. What do you think?
You know what? Good try, but it doesn't sound like me at all.
All right. Well, you know, maybe you've really, maybe it's either you just don't have it, I'm misreading it, or it's teeming in your unconscious.
Or maybe I'm just screwed up.
No, don't take it that way. I'm just taking a shot. You know, it was a great dream, though. I really enjoyed it. You take care, Stephanie.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Love your show.
Thanks.
Wow.
She had no...
That's not me.
Okay. Okay, Sam in Somerville, we're taking another dream. What do you got, Sam?
All right, hey, how you doing?
All right.
Hey, just because of like, the whole Blob and Gotham City thing, right, I had a... Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I had a dream where I was basically in The Empire Strikes Back, all right?
Yeah.
And what happened was, like, I was Space Invader, but Chuck Norris was my partner.
Right.
And I left my lightsaber in my bag.
Yeah.
And Vader offered me, like, offered the two of us, like, this funky, like, custom... lightsabers.
Like this.
Really
try
weird.
This.
Exactly. I would just like to hear your interpretation of that. And there's more to it, but I'm not going to bore you guys.
Well, I mean, Chuck Norris, I'm not sure what he might represent.
Was that the Walker Texas Ranger
show? All right. I saw one episode and I thought it was like garbage.
Well, yeah, it's garbage. You play the Texas Ranger, a Texas Ranger, Texas Bush, conservative.
Yeah.
All right. You're up against Darth Vader, who is the evil empire. You don't have your lightsaber. You're feeling impotent and small. What am I going to do? Here, try mine. Try this on for size. Boy,
oh God.
Yeah, that was a super castration dream, dude. That you're feeling powerless in the face of the Texas Ranger in office and the evil empire, and they're trying to give you a lightsaber to use, and you can't trust that one. You better go find your lightsaber.
Oh, God. All
go
right,
find
well,
it. It's got to be around. Go look at home. Thanks, Sam. Take it
all
easy.
All right, Sam. Wow.
The one I feel the most concerned for is Stephanie. She's like, they have this teeming dream full of, you know, warships and, you know, and help. Hey, I got a secret. Don't tell anybody. And she's like, I don't know.
And men happens. With braces around their necks.
I like that one. The tall guy with the
brace around
his neck.
Yeah.
That was an interesting
who can't dream. Leave New York. Can't even get to Jersey.
Oh, man. Because he's tethered with the truth here in the city. Yeah. Wow. All right. So I guess we'll get back into it. We're going to talk about Rumsfeld. We're going to talk about torture.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the State Department's report on global torture.
And scary thing.
It is. And much more when we come back.
It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Did you... That's it. It's 6 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. It is Wednesday morning. Good morning, monkeys, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Primates all. How are you? Nice to talk to you. How are you, Mark Riley?
I'm doing all right.
Nice to see you. I just pulled this up. You know, I didn't plan on talking about this, but I forgot about this, that the Food and Drug Administration asked Congress on Tuesday for authority to dictate label changes for drugs to end the type of haggling with pharmaceutical companies that delayed warnings to Vioxx users about potential heart problems. You know what's going to happen here, Riley? What I see is that they find these dangerous drugs, okay? Eventually, if they get what they want, they're going to put caps on malpractice. They're going to put caps they're going to restrict victims' rights to the point where the most anyone could make is $250,000. That's their tort reform initiative, right?
Yes.
So I think what's going to happen is it doesn't matter how dangerous the drug is, if the pharmaceutical company can just write the lawsuits off in their bottom line. If they're only $250,000, they might actually use it on their labeling and just say, you know, like, if you get sick from this drug, you could win $250,000. Look under cap for details.
Now, you know what the significance of this is in terms of the FDA. Remember that story some months ago about that John Hancock College?
Uh-huh.
The college that was, I want to make sure it was John Hancock, but it was a college like Bob Jones University that essentially trains evangelicals.
It trains a lot of those kids who are now working in the government as interns.
And guess where?
Yeah.
Food and Drug.
Okay.
FDA.
Okay.
That was one of their target agencies.
Okay.
To get their people into that specific agency. Now, you see why.
Yeah, okay, I see why, but what's the connection between a religion and this particular labeling in the FDA?
See, what they want is, it's not just religion.
They want lackeys.
They want lackeys. They want people who are prepared to toe the party line. And the Bush administration has a vested interest in having people who are compliant in terms of the administration's view of these things.
Sure.
This is this nexus between the religious right and the interests of the corporations
so
in this country.
Right. So they don't want kids in there that are going to learn just to respect the ideology without questioning it and sell the FDA out even more to big pharmacy companies.
Industry, good. Consumers, maybe.
Well, that's also within this. This thing I've been reading all morning, which is Davidson Lohr's, you know, the minister from the Universal, the Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, this living under fascism. This isn't fascism. Fascism. Living under fascism. This has been an amazing screed, an amazing rant. You know, it's worth reading the whole thing again. But what you're talking about is one of the elements of fascism is that corporate power is protected. The industrial and business aristocracy of a fascist nation often are the ones who put the government leaders into power, creating a mutually beneficial business/government relationship and power elite.
And here comes the religionists right behind them, right. And they get in bed with them, and they benefit.
Right. Religion and government are intertwined. Governments in fascist nations tend to use the most common religion in the nation as a tool to manipulate public opinion. Religious rhetoric and terminology is common from government leaders, even when the major tenets of the religion are diametrically opposed to the government's policies and actions. Also, obsession with crime and punishment. Under fascist regimes, the police are given almost limitless power to enforce laws. The people are often willing to overlook police abuses and even forego civil liberties in the name of patriotism. There is often a national police force with virtually unlimited power in fascist nations. Cut to death penalty for teenagers has been removed.
Well, the Supreme Court, and it was a 5-4 decision, and it contained a couple of surprises, actually. They ruled that it's unconstitutional to execute juvenile killers. 19 states had this practice. It has been condemned by the international community on a level that most Americans are totally unaware of. But the 5-4 decision throws out the death sentences of 72 people who were under the age of 18 when they committed their crimes. Most notably, Lee Boyd Malvo. Now, if you remember that name a little bit, if it jogs your memory a little, he was the guy that was the D.C. sniper. He was arrested, tried, convicted, the whole nine yards. He was 17 during that death spree.
Yep.
And at this point, Virginia, he's already serving a life sentence, by the way, in Maryland, okay, which did not have the death penalty for him at that time. They were going to try him in Virginia, which did have a death penalty that would have executed him, even though the crime he committed or the crimes he was alleged to have committed in Virginia happened when he was 17. Now that will not happen. And there are some people who are the families of victims of the D.C. sniper who are not happy about the fact that Lee Boyd Malvo will not face the, quote, ultimate penalty.
Well, let's put this into a global context, okay, because the only other countries that kill kids you know, underneath the death penalty are China, Iran, Pakistan, and as you said, Saudi Arabia. All right, so this pulls us out of that group. And it also, you know, adds to some other issues, is that what I'm talking about in terms of fascism and obsessive with crime and punishment, as opposed to rehabilitation or any sort of compassion for people, I understand, not as a victim, but I understand the need for vengeance and the need for payback. But, you know, for somebody to say this, Diane Clements, who is a president of the Houston-based Justice for All Victims Advocacy Group, and obviously an operative member of one of the neocon death cults, you know, zombie brigades, she says the Supreme Court has opened the door for more innocent people to suffer by 16 and 17-year-olds. What kind of statement is that? Here's another quote. I can't wait for Supreme Court to have judges more concerned with American values, American statutes, and American law than what the Europeans think. What does that even mean? Why does she have to, you know, use her, you know, statement, you know, if she's going to talk about victims' rights, talk about it in some sort of honest way with some empathy. Don't just use it to slag Europe and also to, you know, somehow condemn all teenage behavior. You know, this is fascistic doublespeak is what this is. Now, what I want to know, Riley, is, you know, as we move into this, is that, you know, you are somebody, and myself as well, that opposes the death penalty in all cases.
Absolutely.
Why? What is your reason for it?
Because there is no justification for state-sponsored homicide, period.
Right.
Under any circumstances.
And it doesn't do anything.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't do anything other than kill somebody. And, you know, people make this argument. Well, it makes sure that that person is not going to come back out and kill. Well, so does life in prison without hope of parole.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, at least in terms of that environment. They're not going to get back out and kill somebody. If you get if you give somebody life in prison without hope of parole, the worst that can happen is somebody gets killed in prison. But bottom line, they'll never be back out on the street again. The average... by the way, sentence that people do for murder in this country, between 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who've been in jail for crimes less than murder who've been in jail for a lot longer than that. But, Mark, there was there were a number of cases in this country going back about the last decade where different states were looking to execute people who had committed crimes, committed murders, in fact, as young as the age of 14. There were some people. There were some people that were on death rows in different states in this country who committed their crimes when they were as young as 14. The court in this case now says that these states are not free to execute. Now,
we can't kill the 14-year-olds?
No, You can't kill a 14-year-old.
Even if they kill somebody, we can't kill them.
You cannot kill them if they were 14 at the time they did the homicide.
That doesn't make any sense. We should be able to kill those kids.
Well, see, that's exactly what Clarence Thomas and three other members of the court believe. Interestingly enough, Sandra Day O'Connor filed a separate dissent. Mm-hmm. What you have here was Scalia, Thomas, O'Connor, and I guess Rehnquist. Yeah, Rehnquist was also a part of the four justice minority. What's interesting is that Anthony Kennedy, who is generally perceived as conservative, sided with the majority. He was the difference here.
Well, what's interesting to me is that, you know, people like Diane Clements, who is the president of the Houston-based Justice for All Victims Advocacy Group, goes out of her way to in her statement, again, to slag European, principles in terms of the death penalty, and also celebrating, it seems, conversely, celebrating our alignment with China, Iran, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia on the freedom. We should have the freedom to kill children if they kill, because that's the way people like that think. That's fascistic thinking, and it's limited, it's narrow-minded, and it's also why, you know, we're not included in this new State Department, survey of torture in the world. You know why? Because we're no longer the barometer of integrity. We're one of the bad guys. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. What's happening? How you doing, Riley?
I'm doing all right,
all
man.
All right, then. Look, you know, I tell you, I'm looking forward to these guests coming up in the next hour here. The next, you know, they're going to be here in about 20 minutes. Michael Tucker and Captain John Powers. Two people behind the film Gunner Palace. This is a documentary that's opening Friday in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, Washington, D.C., about, you know, just the hands-on sort of activity that goes on the day-to-day basis in the Iraqi conflict there, in the war. You know, no matter what you feel about the war, and I've condescended to the troops before, but I'll tell you, this thing just blew my mind in the sense that, like, you know, to see what these guys have to do on a day-to-day basis. This was a group of troops that were, you know, sort of stationed at Uday's old palace.
Yeah.
But just, like, all the stuff that are really above and beyond what you would think is the call of duty and what these guys learned, it was pretty fascinating, and I'm looking forward to talking to them. Right now, let's get into this, the State Department's annual human rights report, all right, with 70 countries around the world with poor records on safeguarding basic democratic rights and freedoms, all right? Some of the countries with chronic abuse records were, you know, North Korea, Syria, Iran, there's Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, it's an amazing just how many people still actively torture people, but it's also amazing how we are no longer a barometer of integrity.
Well, see, now let's talk about two of the countries you just mentioned, Syria and Egypt. Those two countries, it is alleged, the United States has shipped terrorism suspects from here
Right. And,
to those countries.
Outsourcing torture, extraordinary
rendition. Yeah.
So on some level, I guess, the State Department annual human rights report is sort of a brochure for the U.S. military to find different places to engage in certain types of... it should come with a price list.
Well, you know, see, the thing is, people are now starting to connect the dots as far as America is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
They're starting to say, wait a minute, you can't run around telling people how to conduct their business in their countries while you condone this sort of thing, whether it's Alberto Gonzalez, whether it's a 2002 memo from Donald Rumsfeld, whether it's this extraordinary renditioning that has now been documented. The bottom line is, how does America go out in the world and tell people to respect human rights when there are serious questions about the extent to which we actually do respect human rights?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're going to suspend the Geneva Conventions and decide that certain things aren't torture, that, you know, used to be considered torture, it's just that it's a shame. It's a shame that, you know, we've lost that barometer, you know, that we are no longer the nation that people look to for some sort of, you know, moral integrity, at least on the level of the Geneva Conventions.
Well, you know, Mark, Abu Ghraib may have done that in once and for all. The whole idea that American soldiers participated in so in this kind of torture, and that it was again documented.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea, you know, that somehow the government actually condones this sort of thing is something that, you know, Donald Rumsfeld's best arguments aside, still has to be proven to the international community. Donald Rumsfeld himself, the defense secretary, our defense secretary, is himself being sued by both the American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights First, saying that he authorized and then failed to stop the torture of prisoners both in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
And you know why? Because he knew he could sell it. He knew he could sell it to the American people. He knew that the American people would dismiss this because the American people have been so infused with a type of fear and contempt. And I'm drawing again quickly from this Living Under Fascism by Davidson Lohr, that, you know, when you are obsessed, you know, when you have, they've demonized the Iraqi people, they've demonized bin Laden, they demonized Hussein, so whatever they were going to do, he knew that most of America would be like, hey, they deserve it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What's wrong with that? They deserve it. And some of the stuff they did was heinous.
Well, see, Mark, what you have
Rumsfeld should go down, my friend.
Well, see, he should have been gone down. He should have been gone down before the election.
Tell me about this lawsuit.
Well, the lawsuit is saying that the December 2002 memo from Rumsfeld, which expanded the conditions under which people could, they don't want to call it torture, but I guess, what would you call it, confession extraction? However you want to describe it, he authorized new interrogation techniques. And this, of course, was for people that were being held in Guantanamo. Stress positions, hooding, 20-hour interrogations, removing clothing, exploiting phobias, prolonged isolation, sensory deprivation, little things like that. Now, Rumsfeld did come out further down the road and issue a revision to that 2002 report, but the lawsuit alleges that the lawsuits allege that people who were detained in both Iraq and Afghanistan were tortured as a direct result of Rumsfeld broadening. Remember that statement he made to somebody saying, well, you know, I have to stand on my feet for a certain number of hours. What's wrong with them having to stand there?
Yeah.
This is
why? Because no one's humiliating you or urinating on you or smacking your face or having a dog, you know, sort of growling hungrily at your testicles. That's why. There's a little bit of difference, isn't there, Don?
Well, you think. Now, the Defense Department said in a statement, quoting here, there have been multiple investigations into the various aspects of detainee abuse. None have concluded there was a policy of abuse. Now, that, if that's not bureaucratic nonsense, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
The fact is, they're trying to say, well, Rumsfeld had no policy. Well, what do you call that letter in December of 2002?
Right.
It was an expansion of an existing policy.
I'm glad that somebody's taking this up, because it's just this blame dispersal thing that, you know, once you track it to the top, you follow it, you follow the lead all the way up through the minor ranks, right up to Rumsfeld, and they do this thing where they try to get it to break apart underneath them to where, you know, Stephen Cambone, the undersecretary, he should have gone down as well. You know, Rumsfeld's undersecretary. I mean, these guys have to take responsibility for this, but they just think if you don't talk about it, it'll go away. I hope this lawsuit gets some teeth to it, and I hope that, you know, we'll cover it here.
Yeah, well, they want the plaintiffs here, the four Afghan citizens and four Iraqi citizens, they want Rumsfeld's actions declared unconstitutional, a violation of U.S. and international law, and they are seeking money damages for their injuries, and all of them are willing to come to the U.S. to testify. Now, I want wonder if Rumsfeld is prepared, or somebody from the from DOD is prepared to testify in defense of Rumsfeld's policy in answer to these lawsuits.
Now, they'll just try and dismiss it as an international frivolous lawsuit.
Yeah.
Put together by trial lawyers.
Ambulance chasers.
International ambulance chasers. Sick. So we're going to come back with director Michael Tucker and Captain John Powers to talk about the film Gunner Palace, which opens this weekend about the troops in Iraq. It's a documentary, and it's very compelling. So we'll talk to you in a second on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
The show is Morning Sedition. It's the Air America Radio Network. We're going to talk to Director Michael Tucker and Captain John Powers in just a couple minutes about the film Gunner Palace. But right now, every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, San Francisco, birthplace of the Twinkie and home to Dan White's notorious Rice-A-Roni defense.
Right.
Like the armies of a lifeless virus that transforms unsuspecting host cells into ghoulish regeneration pods for Earth's murky matter of pestilence, so do George W. Bush and his army of hibitudinous drones attach themselves to the outer membrane of a tolerant, productive society. It is at this stage when the Bush pandemic gains entrance into that country's cytoplasm, where it deceptively replicates its ideals, thereby infecting its nucleus and cramming the endoplasmic reticulum with indigestible molly muck. The host country then swells to nightmarish proportions, spewing out millions of born-again replicants, but not before the process of microinduction within the food vacuole synthesizes glycolipids and other essential enzymes to produce adenosine triphosphate, or as you know it, ATP.
What?
Okay, I think the metaphor worked pretty well up to the last part.
I don't know.
And man, I kind of lost the thread at the end. Regardless, the ugly cycle of viral non-think continues, you bunch of sad sacks. And no, this isn't the kind of disease you can protect yourself against with obsessive hand-washing, urinating immediately after sex, or even avoiding a white chicken on the way to work. It's far worse. This week, three neocons and Christian groups calling themselves the People's Advocate, the National Tax Limitation Foundation, and the Californians for Public Accountability and Ethical Science, all apparently offshoots of the Joseph Stalin Institute for naming things the opposite of what they really are, filed suit to stop stem cell research approved by California voters last November. Shameful. Ignominious. Filed on behalf of our junk president, these junk lawsuits seek to overturn a 60% public mandate to eradicate things like diabetes, cancer, and whatever the hell mutated those Bush chromosomes to produce a cult that would make the Heaven's Gate people shake their heads and say, wow, that's weird. Even more insidious, these suits come just as California is about to distribute billions of dollars in grants for stem cell research. Yes, reversing the progress of medical science, nullifying the will of the people, and making Americans suffer through more diabetes supply commercials starring Milford Brimley are the ingredients of the George W. Bush healthcare platform, his Xanadu. Hey, Brimley, maybe if you cut down on the brown sugar and scrapple-coated oatmeal for a few weeks, Medicare wouldn't have to subsidize test strips for your fat, grumpy ass.
Oh, wow.
And another thing, cocoon stunk on ice.
Right.
Damn it, Mark, there you go again, getting me started on Wilford Brimley.
What did I do?
You know, my virulent hatred for that wheezing bag of cellulite has almost nothing to do with the Christian rights war against science. Though, if you'd just let me stay on point for once.
Yes.
Looks like you and your fans are going to have to wait a little longer until science finds a cure for male pattern baldness and adult-onset vestigial tails.
What?
Because as long as the Bush administration and that bastard Brimley continue to fight against progress, Mark, your embarrassing man breasts are going to have to keep you off the silver screen. And right here on radio. I call him as I see him, Mark. You know what? That's today's dispatch from
The war on brains.
I don't have man breasts, Mort. I don't think that's very nice.
No, I got to grab at straws when I got nothing else funny to write about.
Oh, wow. What's with that haircut? What are you, seven? That's look, cute. That's a cute haircut.
Don't get me started on Brimley again.
All right. Get out.
Whatever.
All right, man.
Turn off the light, okay?
Yeah, would you? No. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Lowe.
No, it's the other guy.
Oh, I forgot.
All right. Right now, the film Gunner Palace opens on Friday. Director Michael Tucker filmed a group of soldiers in Iraq after the president declared major combat operations had ended in September 2000. In February 2004. The name refers to Uday Hussein's Palace, where the Army 2nd Battalion, 3rd Field Artillery Regiment, or Gunners, called home after the fall of Baghdad. Mike Tucker and retired Army Captain John Powers join us right now. Thanks for being here, fellas.
Thank you. Yes.
Wow, we watched a good chunk of the film this morning, you know, and I thought, look, I'm a guy. I have been, you know, I'm a reactionary person, and I have certainly condescended to the war, but I had no idea what the day-to-day, you know, jobs of the troops that aren't revolving around, you know, basic troop-type jobs. Just, I mean, diplomacy, you know, helping people out. You know, it was pretty mind-blowing. It changed my whole point of view. What drove you to make this film?
I think exactly that. I mean, I'd already been to Baghdad twice.
Uh-huh.
And once you saw what these guys had to deal with, and you took a bunch of armor or infantry or artillery soldiers and threw them into this reconstruction role, plus a combat operations role at the same time. So during the day, you're out trying to, you know, wire up a school or fix a generator or get sewage picked up or garbage picked up. And then at night, you're out raiding houses. It creates a very weird mix of emotions.
Let me ask you a question, Captain. If, you know, when you were there, when you got there, you know, in terms of what you thought was going to happen and what you thought your job was, what was your immediate reaction to the government that sent you there when you saw the job you had to do?
Well, I mean, obviously, we originally went with the thoughts that we'd be doing artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the first couple months when we started being police officers and started running checkpoints and started running propane stations and things of that nature, it was definitely we felt that obviously we weren't trained up for that.
Mm-hmm.
And we took it upon ourselves to train ourselves up for that mm-hmm. situation. It was frustrating, and it was frustrating not really knowing why we had been sent there.
So that was your own initiative. I just want to get that. That's really interesting to me because there were elements of this film that I saw that the things that blew me away was just that you guys were there to blow stuff up. And then all of a sudden, you guys are there, you know, trying to keep things civil in assembly meetings, trying to, you know, that scene where one of you guys has to go out on the street to examine a bag. I mean, I could, it's just a garbage bag, and you've got to go figure out whether or not it's going to blow up just by, you know, a gut instinct. Yeah. That was mind-blowing stuff.
It was definitely mind-blowing stuff. Michael Tucker, there seemed to me, in watching this film, to be a hip-hop sensibility and rhythm to Gunner's Palace. Was that rhythm as prevalent as the film made it seem? When I say prevalent, among the troops?
Yeah, certainly that culture is just permeates barracks life. That's why it's in there. I mean, there's really there are freestyle rappers in the film. There's also kind of a freestyle spoken word poet. And those guys really deliver kind of an emotional analysis of what they're going through that you couldn't get in an interview.
So let me ask you this, is that when you, like, I'm curious because, like you said, that you had much the same feelings I did in terms of, you know, why, you know, you would go look at this, because you felt that the troops were being misrepresented by perhaps the liberal media, perhaps people like me, and that people weren't seeing the sort of day-to-day, you know, events that they were going through and the challenges that they were rising to. Now, what is it that you feel about these kids that, you know, they were put in this position? And they, you know, from small towns, you went out of your way to point out. Do you feel that, you know, that the government has, you know, sort of not taken full responsibility for taking care of what these guys had to do and preparing them properly?
Well, I think they weren't prepared. You know, in that summer of 2003, leading up to when I started filming, there was the UN bombing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all NGOs and humanitarian groups pulled out of Iraq. I mean, practically all of them. And then you have the DOD basically running what state should be running. You didn't have you had a core group of people sitting in the green zone giving out orders, funneling out money, but who was supposed to do everything?
Right, so you had these 60 to 70-year-old neocon guys who had, you know, basically putting these kids in harm's way with an invasion that they had no idea would end or how it would come out or what they were supposed to do. And then you had kids like the captain here who were put in there. I don't mean to call you a kid. You're not a
sure.
kid.
I'm
that,
kid.
You know, really had to, you know, figure out their own way there. It's pretty profound.
Well, what was amazing was just seeing... Once you stood in their shoes and saw how confusing it was, I mean, really, during the day, you're doing all this good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it did feel like good stuff. And I think the kids were really proud of what they were doing. And I mean, there were smiles and there were good reactions from the Iraqi people. And I think there was a point when it actually could have worked. And then suddenly having it flip and it just became like night and day. Like suddenly you're living in hell and people are trying to kill you 24/7 and not having any explanation for that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that when we come back. We're going to hear a couple of clips from the film. We're also going to talk about your relationships with the Iraqis that you did meet and that deterioration of trust when you had, you know, somebody that you were working with who turned out to be an insurgent. Is that correct? So we'll get back to that when we come back. We're talking to director Michael Tucker and Captain John Powers, a couple of people behind the film Gunner Palace. It's 44 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest-rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Our $87 billion budget provided for us to have some secondary armor put on top of our thin-skinned Humvees. This armor was made in Iraq. It's high-quality metal, and it will probably slow down the shrapnel so that it stays in your body instead of going clean through. And that's about it.
That's a little bit of a dark comedy, I would say, from the film Gunner Palace. We are talking to director Michael Tucker, and Captain John Powers is here with us. We are talking about the film, which opens on Friday in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. What I'd like to talk about is that we hear a lot about the Iraqi National Guard being trained and about there's a certain element of like not knowing who the insurgents are, and also plenty of people who are too frightened to fight alongside the Americans or be associated with Americans out of fear for their own lives. And you've got, Captain Powers, you've got a story about that personal experience, eh?
Sure, yeah. We're given about 200 Iraqi Civil Defense Corps soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and we're told to train them, clothe them, feed them. Preparing for combat, and unfortunately we weren't given much time to do this, and we're given no plan to do this, so we made this up as we went along. We trained these guys up, and we trained them out of their own homes. They'd come to work every day, they'd ride the bus back to their house every afternoon. And unfortunately, that about a few months into the training, when things started to get hot with the Saudis militia got fired up, we needed these guys to go on a mission, and we had 7 show up to work of 200.
Out of 200. Mm.
So it was pretty demoralizing for our guys, pretty demoralizing for everyone involved to see this. Find out a lot of these guys had sold their weapons off. A lot of these guys are fighting for their side. So it may, unfortunately, I mean, I think now they have a much better plan on how they're doing this. But, you know, this experiment that was happening was really affecting us on the ground.
How do you think it'll be when the Americans leave? I mean, if that's the momentum, I mean, these people are able to take more responsibility for their own country. Do you think that is going to change things?
You know, I think, I mean, they really do need to step up to take responsibility for their own country, or we're not going to be able to leave for a long time. And unfortunately, it's going to be a long time until that happens. I mean, they talk about 140,000 trained soldiers or whatever the numbers they're throwing around now. And, I mean, it's obviously not the case. There's no way they trained that much in the six or 8 months since we've been gone. But the Iraqis do want their own country back. You know, whether they want the Americans there or not. Or they really don't want the Americans there, but they know they need them there. But they want their own country back. They want stability. These people want a normal life for the most part. There's a chunk of them that love the insurgency, that love the idea of warfare, that love the idea of instability. But a lot of those guys are foreign fighters, and a lot of them are just a small group.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the people who was profiled in Gunner Palace, Lieutenant Ben Colgan, was killed.
It's subsequent, obviously, to the filming of the movie, and it was mentioned actually in the film. And there is apparently there was some question about whether or not an Iraqi interpreter who was also in the film in the early part of the film might have contributed to Lieutenant Colgan's death. Is that accurate?
That's not so much Lieutenant Colgan's death. I mean, there was one interpreter after two other soldiers were killed. Actually, it was a soldier that was John's driver previously, was killed on, December 22nd. This insurgent, it looked like he may have been taking photos of vehicles and then passing them back to the insurgents. He was detained. He's in Abu Ghraib now. And that was really, I had filmed him on a previous trip to Baghdad with these guys, and he was, kind of my Iraqi hero. He was, this young guy, looked great, spoke, fantastic English, was really pumped up about rebuilding the country, and then suddenly to see that happen and see how demoralizing that was for the soldiers who really loved and liked him, who had been to his home, met his parents, to suddenly have him there in flexi cuffs, detained, being hauled off to Abu Ghraib was pretty intense.
It's interesting that, a lot of liberals, progressives, and just some people think that, that the insurgency are the people to be, sympathized with. And some people think that, certainly from the liberal spectrum, the left, that the Americans are the horrible thing that happened to this country. And I got to tell you that, after seeing the footage that you put forth and seeing these guys, like Captain Powers and the people he was working with, some of the troops, that, there's a humanity to what they're doing that a lot of people don't realize. A lot of people automatically think that everybody is like, the people that were in Abu Ghraib, that they're there just to beat the hell out of innocent people. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of Iraqi casualties. There's a lot of American casualties, and it's interesting that there is such a disconnect between someone like me who talks about the war 3-4 days a week and what's really going on there. And there's a bit in here that we want to hear Sergeant Robert Beatty to get into this conversation.
You sit in your couch and you watch the TV. And you go to your 9-to-5 job and you complain about the pizza being late, there's no way you're going to know how we live here. If someone being sympathetic to this, I don't even know if I'd be sympathetic if I wasn't in the army. After you watch this, you're going to go get your popcorn out of the microwave and talk about what I say. And you'll forget me by the end of this. Only people who remember this is us.
Now, you want people to us, me, regular people here in the United States who don't have friends in the military, to remember this in a different way, to see this. Isn't that part of your goal?
I think one of the main issues is this is not like previous wars. We had a screening last night with the Vietnam Veterans Foundation of America, and they were trying to compare Vietnam and Iraq. One of the biggest differences is this is not a drafty army. It's mm-hmm. a volunteer professional army. It's a very small army. It's a very close-knit army. We've got guys who are on their third deployments now.
Yeah.
Since 9/11. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge disconnect between the civilian population. I mean, not all of us do not know someone who's over there.
Yeah, it's a fact, and it really comes through. And I want to thank you, Captain, for what you're doing, and I want to thank you for this film, because it really made me see something in a way that I had not seen it before. And I wish you luck in getting this message out, because it is a human story, and it definitely put a human face on certainly one element of what's going on over there for me.
For sure. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
The movie's out this Friday in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York, and Washington, D.C. It's called Gunner Palace. It's directed by Michael Tucker, who is here, and Captain John Powers. Thanks again, fellas. Appreciate you being here. Now we're going to get the facts in from the Streisand compound. This is the liberal agenda for today. Write these down, folks. These are your marching orders. One, today is Dr. Seuss's birthday, so drop acid and reread Green Eggs and Ham. Learn a little something. Two, after they take down the Cristo gates from Central Park, have them reinstalled at polling places to increase voter turnout in 2006. How's that? Three, insist that Michael Jackson's jury be half black and half white like he is. Four, try to obtain federal funds to combat post-movie award season depression syndrome. And five, today's phrase is dropping into conversation. Gonzalez cracking down on obscenity is like rats cracking down on cheese, man. Go through his hard drive, man. I'll bet you find some real interesting JPEGs there. Wake up, sheeple. The wet dream is over. Again, thank you again, fellas. Captain Powers, Michael Tucker, appreciate it. Riley, what do we got going tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow we're going to get back to Frank Luntz's 14 words. We're not finished with
that
yet.
We've still got like six more.
We've got six more to do.
Some more of our own reframings.
We're also going to talk to a constitutional lawyer who's going before the Supreme Court to advocate for the removal of the Ten Commandments monument from the grounds of the Texas Capitol.
Okay.
So that's going to be fun to discuss, too.
That hearing's today. So
yes, that hearing's going on today.
Well, it's good talking to you, Riley.
Good talking to you. It was an interesting day, huh?
I'll say.
It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.